Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So I've been asked to talk about whether we have free will. And I suppose the expectation is that I'll try to defend the existence of free will. And I guess in a sense that's what I'll do, but maybe in a kind of indirect way. Because I don't think that the existence of free will really needs to be proved or defended, at least directly. It's kind of too obvious to doubt in a real way, in a practical way, I think. Every time we stop and deliberate about what we're going to do, we're exercising our free will, I would say. And it seems to me that often, even the people who argue against free will, and there are a lot of them, but often in the very course of their arguments, they seem to assume that we have it. I'll just give you one example. I suppose that at least some of you have heard of Sam Harris. And he's pretty well known. If you haven't heard of him, he's a contemporary author and speaker, a very popular one. If his book sales and his YouTube views are any indication, he argues against a lot of things. Actually, I'm not sure if he argues for anything in particular. I don't know. But one of the things he argues against is free will. And he gives several arguments. I'll refer to one of them later in the lecture. But one of the things he also tries to do is to show us that we really ought to prefer to believe that we don't have free will. And why does he do that? Because if there's no free will, then you can't really blame people for anything. Okay? They can't help it. They can't help what they do. And that's kind of comforting. Okay? Not only because then I can't be blamed, you know, it's comforting in the first person, but also kind of less egoistically, I can't blame the others either. If they can't help it, and I can't blame them, they're not free, then I really can't get angry with them or be disappointed or upset or offended. Right? I can be more at peace. Belief in free will kind of leads to conflict. That's the claim. Well, maybe there's some truth in that. I wouldn't want to deny that. That might be true. But I just have two comments on that. This is not the main gist of my paper, but I'd like to say two things. First, if it's true that there's no blame without free will, and that is true, I think, but it's also true that there's no praise. And to deny free will is to deny responsibility not only for the bad things we do, but also for the good things. And so if I can't get angry with people, I can't be grateful to them either. If they treat me well, it's not because they freely choose to do so, but again, because they can't help it. In fact, if Aristotle is right, I think to deny free will is to deny even the possibility of real friendship between people. That's another topic. But the other thing I'd like to say is that I think it's kind of curious that Mr. Harris should spend so much time trying to persuade us that it's better to believe in free will, that we don't have free will, than to believe that we do. Because he's speaking as if we had some choice about what we believe, okay? Which is not very consistent with what he wants us to believe, it seems to me. It seems to me he's kind of assuming free will even when he argues against it. Well, maybe he could say that if he does go around saying these things, it's because he can't help it. Maybe he could say that too. He's not free to do otherwise. I don't at all want to say that he's in bad faith. I think he's very serious about his arguments, and they're interesting. I think it's more what a famous philosopher of the last century said, Etienne Gilson. He said once, what philosophers know as men, they're liable to forget as philosophers. Right? I think there's a lot of truth in that. Or if they don't forget it, they get confused about it because the topics are very difficult. Free will, as I said before, I think free will in practice is pretty obvious. But in philosophical theory, it's there are a lot of problems associated with it, a lot of difficulties. And I'm not going to be able to address all of them or even most of them tonight. But I think that some of them are the result of a kind of confusion, in the sense that I think at least some of the problems that are raised about free will are based on a misconception, a faulty concept of free will. So sometimes if people ask me, you know, what's the answer to that question, is the will free? Do we have free will? I tend to answer, well, it depends, right? Depends on what you mean by being free. So basically what I want to do in this talk is just one thing. I want to sketch a fairly precise concept of free will. And I think if we have a clear concept of it, we'll be far less likely to deny that it exists. That will clear up not all of the problems, certainly, but a number of them. And of course, I'll be drawing a good deal on St. Thomas Aquinas, on his understanding of free choice. So what I have to say is divided into two parts. The first thing I want to do, I want to go over some things, five of them, that free will is not for Aquinas. Five things that he doesn't think are involved in the freedom of the will. And then I'll talk about what I think is kind of the positive core of the nature of free will in Aquinas' view. And I think this is maybe, it's a good way, if not the best way, to defend the existence of free will, just to get clear about what it's supposed to be. So here are those five things. First, Thomas doesn't think that the will is free about everything. What do I mean by the will? The will, in Thomas's vocabulary, it means our capacity to want things or tend to things, desire things that we think are good with our reason, with our minds, that we understand or think to be good, and to avoid or shun things that we think are bad. Very simple concept of the will. He calls it the rational appetite or the intellectual appetite. And there's at least one thing for him that we absolutely have to want. We can't help it with our wills. We're naturally determined to want it. And it's what he calls happiness, or beatitude. Everybody wants to be happy. You can't help it. To be, what is it to be happy? To be happy is just to have the total good, all good, to have what literally leaves nothing to be desired. Okay? You got it all. And that's what we want. And there's also something that we cannot want, we can't possibly want, something we necessarily shun or shrink from. And that's the opposite of happiness, which he calls misery. Nobody wants to be miserable. Now, that's a very general concept, obviously, and people, and he's the first one to say, people have differ a lot on as to what happiness consists in, what that total good or perfect good would be if we could have it or if we can have it. Okay? And that's where we see a lot of differences among people. Okay? So it's a very general concept, but it's not nothing. Okay? And you might say, well, that's kind of a limit on free will. That's kind of a constraint. And there have been philosophers who think that we're free even about that, right? About happiness and misery, that the will can even go against happiness or for misery. And wouldn't we be freer if that were the case? Right? Well, Thomas doesn't think so, because he sees, and I think this is really important, because we talk about free will as though the will is just free or not, but he sees this necessary desire in the will as kind of the motor of the freedom of the will, of the freedom of choice. It's what drives free choice, right? I would call it the master desire. We've got one desire, which is the master of all our desires. Okay? This is a desire for happiness. And it gives us a kind of mastery over our other desires. It enables us to kind of determine ourselves, right? To decide for ourselves about anything that falls short of the total good, any partial good, right? Any limited good, anything that's partly good and partly not, right? And that's the domain of free will. That's the sphere in which the will, he thinks, is free. And without that determination, that necessary desire for the total good, we wouldn't be free, because we would just be passive. We would just be kind of bounced around from one desire to another, one good to another. And in that sense, we'd be kind of like slaves, driven by our various urges, and whichever urge just kind of wins out, right? That's what would control our actions. So now in the second part of the lecture, I'll go more into how that works, that self-determination based on the desire to happiness. But I just wanted to make this statement, first of all, that the will is not free about everything. And that's essential to the freedom of the will itself. Okay, another thing, a second thing that the free will is not, is a power to act at random or for no reason. Maybe we do a lot of things for no reason, on the spur of the moment, just on a whim, and you can't really say why you did that afterwards. Why did I do that? I don't know. And maybe those things, too, we're not really determined to do them. In some sense, we do them freely, but we don't determine ourselves either. Again, this concept of self-determination, we're going to keep coming back to that. We kind of just let ourselves go and do whatever happens, and that's not really what free will is about. Free will is primarily something active. It's not passive. Again, it's to be in command. It's to be the master over your own actions. And there is an act which Thomas thinks is kind of at the core of free will. The fundamental act of free will is what he calls choice. Electio, in Latin, election, obviously, just means choice. We exercise our free will primarily in making choices. And he gives a great formula. I think it's really good. What is a choice? He gives us a really nice definition of choice. Very simple. He says to choose is to take one thing, refusing another. To take this, refusing that. So I'll look at that formula more closely in the second part of the lecture. But what I'm going to say right now is when we do that, when we take one thing rather than another, we got them both in view and we prefer one to the other, we always have a reason for it. It may not be a very good reason. It may be a lousy reason, but it's a reason. We take one rather than the other because the one seems somehow better to us at that moment than the other. And that's our reason. We've made a comparison and we've used that reason and we've accepted it and applied it to our will. We formed our desire according to that reason. I think this is really important because a lot of times today, I think the question of free will is treated as though it were a power of doing things for no reason, right? Just acting on a whim or acting at random. Right? And the result of that is if it turns out that the things that we do for no reason, which I think there might very well be, if those can be explained without reference to any sort of special power, like free choice, then there would be no grounds for believing in free choice, right? And one of the arguments that Sam Harris invokes sometimes is kind of along these lines, it seems to me, right? Harris cites an experiment that was conducted in the 1980s, maybe you've heard of this, by a scientist named Benjamin Libet. Anybody heard of the Libet experiment? It became famous because it seemed to present kind of hard empirical evidence that the things that we think we do freely are really determined by unconscious processes in the brain. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the experiment because, as a matter of fact, this is not my field, obviously, so I'm just going by what others say. But in recent years, scientists have generally, I think, come to realize that as evidence about free will, the experiment was not very well designed. So it's been kind of debunked. Just as a scientific experiment, right? What they say anyway is that it kind of took for granted the very thing that it claimed to show, namely that the human actions whose performance was in question, whether it was free or not, it was taking it for granted that those actions were caused by certain events in the brain. Right? We're just taking that for granted rather than actually proving that. Right? So that kind of is a problem with the experiment. But what interests me about the experiment, though, is something else. Whether or not it was good as an empirical study, it seems to me that the experiment had little or nothing to do with free will in the first place, because the actions that it focused on were things that people did kind of at random, for no reason. Things like flexing a finger at a certain moment, or making some other bodily movement, or pressing a button now or some other time, right? And so kind of meaningless bodily events, right? that they had control over, obviously. And in some sense, we might want to say they did them freely, but they had really no reason for doing it. Why did I press the button now and not 5 seconds from now? I don't know. I just felt like it. We can make choices about those things, okay? But usually we don't because they're too trivial. We don't bother to deliberate. We don't bother to say, is it better to do this or not? We just sort of go ahead or don't go ahead, right? So that's not the place to look for free will. And that's what they were doing. So it seems to me it's not talking about the real issue. So that's the second thing. Free will is not a power to act at random. A third one, which is connected with that, is that we shouldn't think that acts of free choice, if they exist, are uncaused acts, acts that have no cause at all. They always have reasons. That was my second point. And they certainly do have causes, usually a number of causes. The reasons themselves, I would say, are causes. Why did you do that? Because I thought it was better. This, that, and the other reason. Okay. What's a cause? Well, among other things, it's something upon which something else, the existence of something else, depends. And the existence of a choice, the performance of a choice, depends on a lot of things. Depends on the chooser. Without a chooser, it's hard to have a choice, right? Obviously, right? It depends on that desire for happiness, because it's always, we always choose what seems better, which is to say more good, which is to say tends toward the perfect good, the complete good, right? Somehow. And there are usually a lot of other factors that influence our reasons for our choices, and those are causes too. I don't know, suppose you stop studying and decide to get a pizza. It's better to get a pizza now than to study. Why? Well, because I'm hungry. That's a reason. So my hunger influences my choice. It makes it seem better to get a pizza than to study. And why this pizzeria rather than that pizzeria? Well, a friend of mine told me that this is better or that it's less expensive or whatever, right? So that's also an influence, the advice I got from my friend. There's a million things that go into the formation of our choices. Okay? So the fact that the choices have causes and influences is not incompatible with their being free. What would be incompatible with their being free is they're being determined by their causes, so that the causes taken together make it impossible for you to choose otherwise, right? Or to do otherwise. To say that a thing is determined by its causes is to say that its causes make it necessary, make its not existing impossible. So you choose to eat because you're hungry. Does that mean that your being hungry makes it impossible for you not to eat or not to choose to eat? Well, obviously not. Obviously, in fact, sometimes you might choose not to eat precisely because you're hungry. Catholics now, we're in Lent, right? In Lent, we're supposed to deny ourselves sometimes. We get hungry and say, I'm not going to have that hamburger because I'm hungry, right? And I'm going to deny myself, right? So the hunger doesn't determine me. Sometimes it's my reason. Sometimes it's my reason for doing the opposite choice. You might do it just to prove that you can. So having free choice means we have the power to determine our own choices and our own desires. In fact, I would put it this way. A choice is a determination, one made by the person who chooses, a determination of your desire. And you make that determination. And so it can't be predetermined by other causes. If it's predetermined, then you can't determine it because it's already determined. You can't determine what's already determined any more than you can heat what's already hot. You can't do it, right? It's the same thing. So if it were determined by its causes, then it wouldn't be a free choice at all. It wouldn't be a choice. It really wouldn't be a choice even, I think. So that's the third thing. Acts of free choice can very well have causes, not causes that determine them or make them necessary. The fourth thing is that the freedom of choice, just as it's not incompatible with causes, with having causes, it's not incompatible with a good deal of predictability in our behavior. Human behavior is very predictable in a lot of ways. And that's the result of two things, at least for St. Thomas. One is that the influences on our behavior are themselves fairly predictable. the physical world and the human world and our own makeup, our own bodily makeup, our own psychic makeup, if I can speak that way, they have a good deal of stability about them. We get to know them. We understand how they work. You know, St. Thomas, this may be surprising, but St. Thomas thought that astrology, that astrologers could predict pretty well on a large scale human behavior. And you know, they could predict based on the sort of the natural temperament of people born under a certain sign or born under a certain grouping of the stars. He thought it could do that because he thought that the stars, the heavenly bodies, influence our own bodies in certain ways. And our own bodily constitution, he thought, has a lot to do with our temperament. And our temperament has a big influence on our choices. Today, we might not be so impressed by the influence of the stars, right? But we would talk about genetic endowment or climate or whatever, right? Early upbringing. He thought that people tend to make choices in accordance with their temperaments. So if you're an irascible person, and maybe that's just your makeup, right? You were born that way, as we'd say. I tend to get angry easily. Well, people who do that, they also tend to make choices that will satisfy their anger. Okay? It's just kind of the way it works. But the question is whether that temperament and that disposition, whether it determines their choices. And that's where Thomas says, well, no. It doesn't absolutely determine them. Because we can reflect on our choices. And we can reflect on our temperaments, even. And work against them if we want to. A person might discover one day, maybe people tell him, look, you know, you get angry so easily. Why don't you work on that? You know, why don't you, instead of giving in your anger, why don't you hold back and find ways of controlling yourself? And people do that. And there are a lot of cases of people who really quite can change their disposition, change their temperament very radically. It takes effort. It's not easy. But the question is whether our behavior is determined. And that's the point. And in fact, regarding astrology, so Thomas thinks that astrology can predict on a large scale, but it doesn't say that our actions are determined. And he has a quotation from Ptolemy, you know, the ancient astronomer, the famous ancient astronomer. Ptolemy says, the wise man is above the stars. So that's the intellect. The intellect can stand above the influence on our bodies of the stars. And act freely and have that mastery over our behavior. Now, our choices have some predictability also, because when we first make choices in response to a certain influence, that itself has a certain power to influence our subsequent choices. In other words, it tends to create habits. We form habits of character, good habits, habits of choice. Good habits are called virtues. Bad habits are called vices, and those make up our character. And again, it's hard to go against one's character. Our character gets formed over a period of time, right? And once the character is kind of set, it's very difficult to act contrary to one's character. But again, it's the same point applies. People still can work on their characters. They don't always have to act in accordance with their characters, and it's possible. And Thomas thinks maybe sometimes this requires some divine help even. But it's possible to change one's character and to work on one's character. Last point, I mentioned virtues and vices, which takes us back to the idea of responsibility, moral responsibility, responsibility for good and evil. So free choice, and this is what we tend to think of when we think of free choice, the whole question of choosing between good and evil, right and wrong. But this is the last point I want to make about what free choice is not, at least for St. Thomas. It's not only, and not even primarily, a capacity to choose between moral good and evil, or between right and wrong. It is that, in our case, but that's not even strictly essential to free choice, to be able to choose between good and evil. It's not essential. To make choices, yes, but to go between good and bad choices, or to choose between good and evil, no, it's not essential. In fact, he thinks it's kind of an imperfection of the freedom of choice, a weakness of the freedom of choice. It's basically, and I'll come back to this later too, but it's basically the possibility of not using the light of our own reason as fully as we might, as fully as in its is in our power to use it when we make our choices. We don't think them through, at least at the beginning, as fully as we could. And that complicates the situation about free choice for sure. But my point here is that we don't have to think it's essential. And when we think about the existence of free choice, whether we have free choice or not, we shouldn't start there. Don't start there with good and evil, because it's kind of complicated. The question of explaining the possibility of choosing between good and evil. Start with the power to choose between morally acceptable things, okay things, but serious things. You know, I don't know, the power to choose a career. I'm going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or even a philosophy professor. Even that's a good thing. It's a joke. You're supposed to laugh at it. or to choose my friends, or to choose where I'm going to live, or to choose a spouse. Those are serious choices, right? Very serious choices. The time since we're free about it. But the question of good and evil at least doesn't directly enter into those things. Wait for the question of good and evil down the road a little bit. I'll come back to that, but I want to flag that it's not the primary thing that we should be looking at when we ask about free choice. So just to sum up, there's these five things. It's not a power to choose absolutely anything. You can't choose misery. It's not a power to act at random or for no reason. It's not a power to perform acts that have no causes at all. It's not incompatible with acting in predictable ways. And it's not essentially or primarily a power to choose between good and evil, moral good and evil. Okay, so having said what it isn't, let me try to say something about what it is. Earlier I mentioned that description that Thomas gives us of choice, of what it is to choose, taking one thing and refusing another. So a choice is kind of a two-pronged event. It bears both on what you take and what you refuse. You got them both in view. So it's, another word is a decision. It's a decision, which literally means a kind of cutting off. You take this and you cut that off. You set it aside. You cut off one alternative and you take the other. And Thomas says that's where we see the freedom of choice. That's where the will is determining itself. It's taking this rather than that. That's a determination. It's at the beginning, it's indeterminate. It could go either way, and it determines itself in this direction as opposed to that. So how is it that we're capable of that? Well, in his view, there are two factors. One is that we can make comparisons between things. And so typically, not absolutely always, but typically when we make, before we make a choice, we engage in what he calls deliberation. We have some goal in mind, and we need to decide what to do about that goal or in order to attain that goal. So we look over the field, and we find that the field offers some alternatives, some different possibilities. We study them. We gather up the pros and the cons, right? We compare them with each other. And when we finally choose one, again, it's because there's something about that one that makes it seem better to us than the one we reject. That's the reason, again, for our choice. So we always choose for a reason. And it's reason which is capable of this, of making comparisons. Thomas could offer you an analysis of the act of comparing and why it depends on reason, capacity for grasping what he calls universals. I won't go into that now. But that's one of the things that's required for free choice. It's not the only thing. It's not the only thing, because a lot of comparisons have kind of predetermined results. There are some comparisons that can only go one way. So if we're interested in size, something big, right? Well, we compare the number 3 and the number 6. Well, there's really only one answer. Well, what are the pros and cons there? What are the factors for and against? There's only one possibility. But usually when we deliberate, when we're in the practical activity of deliberation, there are a lot of factors. Size might be one of them. You want to choose a bigger thing, a bigger pizza. I want the biggest pizza. Give me the biggest pizza. But usually there are other factors too. We're asking which one is better, which alternative is better. So we're asking about the goodness of the things, which one is more desirable. That's just another word for good in Thomas's vocabulary, desirable. And again, we're looking at things from the point of view of that master desire, the total good, the desire for happiness. But the point is here that for Thomas, and I think this is obvious, goodness Just when you think about goodness, that's something really huge. And it's a lot bigger than just size, so to speak. Size is only one characteristic of things. Goodness belongs to many different features of things. The way Thomas puts it, very simple, it is in Latin, it's bonum est multiplex. The good is manifold, or the good is multiple. There are many forms of goodness. There are not just many good things. Goodness comes in many forms. There isn't just one thing. This is sort of Thomas, if you've read Plato, you know, the idea of the good. Well, Thomas thinks there's no such thing. It has many forms, many forms. And what it is for a pizza to be good is one thing. What it is for an essay, you have to write an essay that's kind of different from the goodness of a pizza. You hope your professor's not going to eat your essay. Okay? It's totally different. What do you even have in common? They're both good. A good pizza, a good piece of music, a good horse, a good spouse, right? A good place to live. It's just what goodness is variable, is as much variety as the kinds of things that there are, because each has its own kind of goodness. So it's huge. It's enormous. Even negative things can be good. Heat is a good thing, but turning off the heat can be good too. Too much of a good thing is not good. So it's just enormous. You can't pin it down to just one form or one formula, if I can put it that way. And that has a lot to do with the question of freedom of choice, because it means that normally when we're choosing between alternatives, the alternative that is better in one respect, that is more good with respect to one form of goodness, is less good in another respect. It has less of another form of good. That's all. It's a very simple idea. And in fact, this is always going to be the case with particular, what Thomas calls particular goods, that is, goods that fall short of the perfect good, the total good. Everything else lacks some portion of goodness or some kind of goodness. Again, we can't help but want happiness, but everything else, there can be alternatives, right? So just a really simple example. Suppose I need a car. I need a car. That's my goal. I need a car. Can't get to work without a car. Okay, so I've got, just to make it really simple, I've got two possibilities. I've boiled it down to two alternatives. One is beautiful, fancy, glamorous car. It's fast. I like to drive fast. I like to kind of show off, okay? And it's really cool, but it's pretty expensive. Another car, it's much more economical. The other possibility is much more economical. I'll save a lot of money and all, but it's kind of clunky. It's kind of ugly and clunky. It doesn't go very fast. So I'm interested in economy, but I'm also interested in the glamour or the speed or whatever, right? Well, I could afford the glamorous one, but not easily. And I could put up with my friends making fun of the clunky one, but I'm kind of touchy, so that would be hard for me to put up with too. So it's not an easy choice. So what do? I could keep on deliberating. One has a better sound system, but that could leave me in the same position as before, no clear winner. And Thomas's point is, I don't have to have a clear winner, a knockdown argument, that this is obviously just the thing. That's usually not the case. Usually there are reasons on both sides, and good reasons often on both sides. And I can still make the choice, and I just have to make the choice. I can just say, well, I'm just going to go with the economical car. I'm going to go with that one. I can see the reasons for going with the other one, but I'm going to go with this one. If I go with it, it's because of what makes it seem better and the respect in which it's better. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't be able to choose it. But I also had reasons for not choosing it, and I could have gone with those. I could have taken the other car. And maybe I'm always looking over my shoulder at the other car while I'm buying this one, right? Because I haven't forgotten it. I haven't put it out of my mind. It's still there. I am really rejecting it when I could be taking it. That's what a choice is. And it's I who make the choice. And nothing makes it for me. My own deliberation doesn't make it for me, because it leaves it open. It gives me reasons, but it doesn't, as I say, it's not a knockdown argument. It doesn't determine the reason. Yeah, I don't want to, this. You could go into more detail about this question about having reasons. Do I have to have reasons for why I prefer these reasons to those reasons? And that can get really complicated. I just want to argue, and I could go into that, but I don't have time. I just want to argue that I can go forward with reasons that aren't necessitating reasons. And I can and I usually do make choices on those bases. And those choices are therefore free. I could choose otherwise. But there's still another objection, which brings us back to the question of good and evil. Because I said before that we desire happiness necessarily and everything else somehow in function of that desire, when we will. Now, there are some things that we take, that a person can take to be necessary for his happiness or her happiness, right? They really have no choice about. For instance, Christians take avoiding sin to be necessary for their happiness. If you sin, that's going against your own happiness. So insofar as they're Christians, they can't think that it's better to sin than not to sin. They can't think that. And yet it's possible for a Christian to choose to sin. At least that's what they told me. That's what they told us in the seminary, right? That it's possible, right? But then it seems again that we're back to the idea, well, they're choosing for no reason, right? Or that in the end, they aren't making the choice, that the choice is something that sort of happens in them against their own minds. Something else makes it for them and foists itself upon them. So this is the question of the choice between good and evil. And as I said, that adds a bit of a complication. But let me just try to go into this quick. Thomas doesn't think that the choice of sin, in his language, is an exception to the rule that we always choose for a reason, or that what we choose always has a feature that makes it seem somehow better. What's distinctive about the choice of sin is that the reason is not a good one. The sin does seem better to the person at the moment when he or she chooses it, but only from a limited perspective or a partial perspective. That's enough to make it possible to choose, to make that choice. When Christians consider life as a whole and stand back and ask what is most worth pursuing, then they see that sin is not really an option. But they're not always taking that point of view. We have to make an effort to take that point of view, right? And it's up to us to make that effort or not. Making that effort is something that it's not always the right moment to make that effort. We don't have to make that effort to look at things from that point of view. And when we're not in that point of view, something that is in fact sinful can present itself to us, present an attractive face, and because it really has something good, something attractive about it. And that's enough to be able to choose it. Instead of stopping and saying, wait a minute, is this really, all things considered, is this really what I want to do? Yeah. We can just go ahead and choose it. So again, we're free and we have a reason, right? And people sometimes do, you know, it does actually happen. People do resist temptation sometimes, believe it or not, right? They actually do, they say no, right? So that happens, but sometimes they don't. So he has an explanation for that. As I said before, Thomas doesn't think that the power to choose between good and evil is essential. And you might wonder, can there be free choice without the possibility of doing evil, or in his language, the possibility of sinning? Is there free choice in heaven? Because he thinks in heaven, sin is impossible. He just follows Augustine and the Christian tradition. In heaven, with the vision of God, you can't sin. You can't choose. It's unthinkable to choose to offend God when you're seeing him. Well, I would say that on Thomas's view, heaven is where free choice really comes into its own. That's where you have more free choice than ever. What we have in this life is only kind of a shadow of it, because what we know in this life is only kind of a shadow of the real good. Let me give you an analogy. I hope this helps. Think of that heavenly musician, Mozart. Because I like Mozart. I don't know if you like Mozart. Okay, you've got Mozart here, and you've got an amateur hack, right, like me. Okay, so we both sit down at the piano. When Mozart plays, he can't make a musical blunder. He can't make a musical sin. He can't. It would kill him. He just can't. Whatever he does, it's great. It's beautiful. It's musical. It's wonderful. I can. I can make all sorts of blunders. I'll do it all the time. Okay. Now, which of us has more possibilities at the keyboard? I, who can play well sometimes, badly a lot of other times. He, who can only play well and can't play badly. Well, it's obvious, right? He's got about a million more possibilities in front of him than I'll ever have. Every time he plays, it's something different, something totally different. It's very creative. And it's wonderful. For me, it's like the same three riffs, right? Badly executed. It's just, you know, there's no comparison. He's got way more choice than I've got. Why? Because he's much more into the good of music than I am. He's got that before him. He sees all the richness and the possibilities of it. Well, heaven is like that, only it's the total good. Right? For the most part, you know, sin, and I think I can say this, sin is kind of boring. It's boring. It's pretty much the same old stuff most of the time. Good is not nearly as boring, right? When we know it. When those who see the infinite good in its concrete realization, which is the divine good, Thomas, they also see an endless variety of ways of imitating that good and following it, right? So you've got a myriad of amazing choices that we don't even have a clue about here below. And those in heaven, they have that. Okay, so that was the last point. So just to sum up, a choice is an act of taking one thing, refusing another. The freedom of the choice depends on the power to compare and the multiformity of goodness, the multiplicity, the manifold nature of goodness. Freedom to make bad choices involves a third power, not really a power, but a weakness of not always having in mind what we most deeply want, and not always using that to govern our choices, right? Without that, we'd never do anything blameworthy, that weakness, right? But we would still have free choice. And in that case, not even Sam Harris would mind it, I think. Right? It would not be a source of conflict. We do have the power to make bad choices, but I think if we do, then we'd better admit it and learn how to deal with it.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.